the near post. Messi to the net. Mamma mia! Ramel Kiyoko now. Here's a Hunter. And he'll whip it in back to the far post. Elise! Albert Elise. La Pantolita. It's a Honduran connection.
This is Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN975.com.
Brought to you by the Daspit Law Firm. DaspitLaw.com. From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Glenn Davis.
All right, welcome back to the show. A man on the show right now, Tom Ramos, the manager of the Houston Dynamo. 13-year professional career, and Tom played in Spain, Mexico, the U.S., and many of you will remember when Major League Soccer started in 96, Tab was the first player signed by the league. We're talking about Soccer Town USA, the documentary. You can find it on YouTube. Just type in Soccer Town USA. It is a tremendous watch. You're going to see a very young Tab Ramos in there, but you're going to see an equally impressive story about a town in New Jersey that was predominantly Scottish. And in those days, things were, you know, Scots would live in a certain area, Portuguese in a certain area, certainly in the 80s and 70s. And it was really defined. I think it's a little bit more mixed now. But we welcome back Tab Ramos. Tab, thanks again for doing the second segment with us. When you and I did an interview a while back when you first got here, we did that wonderful sit-down, and you were very enlightening on a lot of subjects. You talked about growing up in Uruguay and how highly competitive, you know, games were at such early ages, you know. And I walked away that day going, you know, I remember what some people were trying to say the model was in the U.S. was, you know, well, we're trying to lay a fundamental base early, and then we bring in tactics and competition at 12 and 13. That wasn't the case in Uruguay, and that's definitely wasn't the case in Kearney, New Jersey, when you guys were playing pickup soccer.
No, it definitely wasn't. You know, when you look at both the way I grew up in Uruguay, where it was mostly about just about winning all the time, and then in Kearney, where it was basically, you know, just go to the, you know, whatever coach we had at the time, you just go to the field and you would throw out a ball, and you would either do some shooting on goal or you would be playing small sided games or full field. That was the extent of our training session. But we knew that whatever the training session was at the time, that was only a small part of what we did in soccer that day, because we would always meet at the courts to play. So we played for hours every day.
How important is the balance between coaching and doing it on your own, and also that in the context of now, that it's very different now? I mean, you know, there's a lot of video things going on. Everybody's got great uniforms. In some ways, it's slightly homogenized. Look, you played a lot of your soccer on dirt fields and asphalt growing up.
Yeah, I mean, the game has changed a lot, but it also, you know, if you look at all different sports, it's sort of the same. You know, if you look at basketball, you look at football or baseball, you know, think of the amount of work that athletes have to do now to stay at the top of the game. You know, it's really difficult to have multiple sport athletes anymore, because you have to be so specialized so early, and you have to, if you play baseball or football, you know, you have to make sure that you do weights and you get stronger and you get bigger and you get, you know, like, not that that wasn't happening before, but it wasn't to the extent that it is now because it's so competitive. And I think, you know, when you look at soccer, sort of the same, you know, that, you know, to be able to be on an MLS team nowadays, you physically have to be like a top level athlete. Otherwise, it's really difficult to get on the field and to be able to survive 90 minutes of a game. I feel like in the past we were, you know, obviously because we didn't know better, but certainly we were way behind. So the sport has changed a lot. And I'm not sure with, you know, doing the same things that we were doing before, we would survive today.
But different surfaces and things like that, are there some things that you hold over from the way you grew up in the game and the way you developed and the ability to experiment and play on your own? Is any of that still achievable with youth players now, or does it have to be highly structured, highly organized, just to get them out there to play?
No, well, I'm not in general a big fan of highly structured. I think there has to be some kind of balance, because there's no question that the best way to develop your relationship with the ball is by having the ball. and by doing things on your own, by trying different things, and by putting yourself in an environment that's not controlled to every move that you have to make. That thing where, you know, an environment where things just happen. Or as Manny Shelshai used to say, you know, the game is the best teacher. And so sometimes you just have to put yourself in those situations where the game teaches you, where you turn and there's three guys, and you know, the coach can warn you about it, but you're only going to learn to be able to turn and get away from dangerous areas by being in those situations. And so the game does teach you a lot. So I think it needs to be a combination of both, you know, and certainly the players in the past were the same or better technically than they are today. That's certainly not a place where the game has moved forward. I just feel like on the physical side, you need to spend time. And that time, without question, takes away time from you being with the ball. And that, at times, changes the game.
Talking to Todd Ramos, manager of the Houston Dynamo. We're talking about the documentary Soccer Town USA as well. Now, you mentioned the courts. So just explain to our listeners the courts and then the freedom you had there, because there weren't adults around. So you guys had to sort arguments out. You had to pick teams. I mean, that's a beautiful counter to and balance to having good coaching.
Yeah, well, the courts were sort of our release, you know, and John Hart does a nice line in there, and what he says, we were sort of not, it seemed like we were not like the best players to come out of Kearney. We were just a generation that sort of got it and had a little bit more of a drive to get out of Kearney and do bigger things. But we sort of grew up watching players who were just as good. At least we felt that way, you know, players who were technically amazing. Players who we thought, wow, these are all going to be professional players. And then somehow, you know, life in those towns, you know, if you watch the documentary, you know, it wasn't an easy town to grow up in. There was a lot of different temptations that, you know, that you had to deal with, and you had to really be focused, and it was not easy to get out of those areas. And we just happened to be the generation of guys that said, hey, you know what, soccer is more important to us than everything else. But there were talented players all along.
Yeah, no question. Back in my day, I can mention Jerry McEwen, Stevie McLean, all guys that I played against. I remember Joe Ellsmore. Even go farther back than that, Huey O'Neill, Santiago, who you've talked about before. So it's just incredible, the riches that came there. By the way, this goes back, this documentary, all the way to 1885 with the Clark Threadmills team. Okay, so this tells you about the immigrants coming to America, and of course the Scottish immigrants are bringing the things with them that they love, including soccer. And I remember there was one point, Tab, where, you know, you kind of get identified as playing maybe in Harrison, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here informationally, but you're playing in Harrison and the word gets out, hey, there's this really talented player, and some people are skeptical, and then they bring you over kind of like a tryout or to a training session, and then all of a sudden everybody goes, yeah, this guy's all right.
Yeah, it kind of happened fast because I moved to the U.S. and for 3 or 4 months I couldn't find any place to play until a friend, you know, one of the kids I'd gotten to know in Harrison came up to me and said, hey, do you want to sign up for Harrison Rec? Not knowing what that was, I signed up for it. I asked my parents, I signed up for it. And I went and played, and when I played my first rec game, actually they took me off the field and they didn't allow me to finish the game because the fields were so small that I could score from goal kicks, and I was just obviously didn't belong there. You know, I show up at a place where the kids were wearing, you know, knee pads, and you know, and it was just not your typical soccer player that I was used to. And so somebody saw me play there, and they're like, okay, well, we're going to take you, you know, if you don't mind, we can talk to your parents, we'll take you to a club in Kearney. That's where, you know, that's where the big soccer club is, and you know, we'll take you there. So they took me there, and I went there for one training session, and obviously after one training session they kept me on, and then, you know, obviously the rest is history there.
Yeah, so the Kearney Pride, I mean, tough guys, a lot of tough guys, tough environment, as you mentioned, a lot of temptation, very strong personalities. Did you kind of have to pass a bit of a litmus test with them, you know, to kind of make that crossover to playing for the Scots and Thistle and playing in Kearney?
Yeah, I mean, it was not easy from a culture standpoint, obviously, because they were used to just having basically only Scottish or Irish players. So here I'm from Uruguay, and, you know, they're usually not taking people from, you know, at least not Latino kids on the team at the time. So that was hard to cross over, and it was something that was new for me because coming from Uruguay, I was not really aware as a kid of any of these type of things. But then also the fact that, you know, as we grew up, then me playing on the team, you know, most people would have the perception, even after you watch the, you know, you watch the documentary, you would have the perception that, you know, when we, you know, when John or I or Tony went to the courts, that people would be like, oh, here come those guys. And it wasn't like that at all. I mean, because there were other guys who had made names before us. So we were just other kids, you know, coming in. We thought we were good, and obviously we proved ourselves so that everybody would pick us on the best team because that's how you stayed on. But by far, it wasn't like, okay, here comes John and here comes Tab, or, you know, it wasn't like that. It was like we were just other guys, and we were lucky to be in teams with, you know, the guys that you mentioned before that were coming back from, you know, from colleges to play, the names that we had been hearing about for years, you know, that were like, oh, my God, that's so-and-so, you know? And yeah. And so, yeah, it was just we had to find our way, and every day was a battle over there.
Tab Ramos, Houston Dynamo manager. We're talking about Kearny, New Jersey, Soccer Town, USA. Again, it's a great documentary. Catch it at YouTube.com. Go over there and just type in Soccer Town, USA. It's really, really engaging. I kind of was wishing it would go on a little bit longer, but it was tremendous. All right, let's move on to the DA. And look, I know there's still lots of things going on with this, so we're not expecting for deep, deep answers here. But how do you think, you know, this whole situation now with the DA is going to change, if at all? Will a lot change?
How it's going to change moving forward, I'm not sure. You know, obviously MLS has stepped in and will take the reins moving forward. And hopefully we'll continue to, you know, to make improvements. You know, one of the things about the DA that I think that has been important over the years is, you know, the DA existed for 13 years. And in those 13 years, there was a lot of important things that happened. You know, coaches learned about the importance of getting their licenses, about being a well-educated coach. Clubs learned about the fact that, you know, training is more important than the games, that you have to have a better ratio of training sessions to games, because when you go to the games, you know, most players don't touch the ball as much, so you need to be practicing more. So there was a lot of things that happened within clubs, like naming of the director of coaching that could now put a curriculum together, a technical director who could implement it. You know, so there's a lot of good things that happened over the last 13 years that were not happening before, at least not everywhere. Certain clubs maybe, but this became sort of a nationwide phenomenon. And I think that, you know, although, yeah, we can talk about some of the things that we can all argue about, whether, you know, eliminating high school soccer was a good thing or not, or whether, you know, putting the calendar year into, you know, January 1st is December 31st, whether that was a good thing or not. So there's things we can argue about over the years, but there's no argument in the fact that the Development Academy did move the game forward. I think what's a little bit sad about this situation is the fact that it almost seems like U.S. soccer just checked out and left a lot of clubs likely stranded who had spent a lot of money over the last however many years trying to follow along what U.S. soccer wanted. And it's not so much about the MLS clubs, but it's about all the rest of the clubs that were not in MLS who spent the money and who wanted to be part of something big and who all of a sudden are left on the street. And that's a difficult thing. But there's no question that the DA for a period of 13 years moved the game forward.
Tab, tremendous two segments. Thank you very much for doing these. I'm sure everybody really enjoyed this conversation with you. We really appreciate you coming on. And, you know, let's hope we get to see you back out on the fields sooner rather than later, okay?
Me too. I can't wait for that. Thank you for having me on.
Always a pleasure, Tab. Thank you very much. Man, that's great stuff with Tab Ramos. And you got a nice comment there from him about the DA at the end of the interview. Soccer Town USA, again, it's exceptional. It's a great story. There's some really funny moments in there as well that you'll like a lot. In fact, I think John Harkes or was it Tony Meola? One of the two of them just said, you know, there's games I don't remember as a pro, but there's games I remember playing in the park that I'll never forget. Something along those lines. So it was pretty good. Taking a break here. John Daspit, Daspit Law Firm. Thank you for your presenting sponsorship of this show. When we come back, we're going to begin to dig a little deeper into the whole Super League combination between Major League Soccer and Liga MX. Tom Marshall, ESPN FC, is going to join us. Always a great guest on the show. That was good stuff with Todd Ramos. We'll have Megan Oyster later in this hour to finish. And let's keep rolling on here. Soccer Matters, ESPN 97.5, brought to you by John Daspit, the Daspit Law Firm. We'll take a break.
You're listening to Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 97.5.com.
Brought to you by the Daspit Law Firm. From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Glenn Davis.
All right, welcome back to the show. We are on a good roll tonight here. Tremendous stuff there with Todd Ramos as we continue on. Couple of things here. Tomorrow night, 7 o'clock. On the Horn in Austin, Texas, is our sister show, also brought to you by John Daspit and the Daspit Law Firm, Daspit Law Austin. We'll have Josh Wolf, the new coach of Austin FC. So interesting to get Josh's take on where Austin FC right now is and how they are positioned from the standpoint of scouting right now, which I'm sure is pretty challenging for them because of the different world that we're in. There is some stuff that's come out by a nice writer up there named Chris Bills, who said that part of the plan was to originally begin signing players in June. So we'll see. But that's tomorrow night, Josh Wolf. Great stuff with Todd Ramos. Now we have another great guy coming on the show, and he's one of the great contributors of this show. Tom Marshall, ESPN FC, joining us from Guadalajara, Mexico. Tom, how are you?
Hi, Glenn. Yeah, not bad. Thanks. Yourself?
Great to have you on, Tom, and I think very timely now. First of all, before we get into anything, you taking care of your health, your family okay? That's the first thing I got to ask you.
Yeah, no, thanks for asking, Glenn. Yeah, I mean, all as good as can be expected, you know, just following the quarantine and what the health authorities are telling us, really. I mean, I think that's all you can do.
For you, when you're at home, has it been a bit of a learning experience? It has for me, because it's made me do things differently. It's made me think differently. It's made me be a little bit more creative. What's it done for you, and what's it done for your writing?
No, it's weird, because it's actually like, you know, as a soccer writer, you don't really have much of a routine. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, you're watching games sometimes at 11 o'clock at night, and you know, over the weekend, it's kind of all, you know, you're watching games a lot of the weekend, and then, you know, in the weekdays, it's kind of mixed what you're doing, and sometimes you've got a lot of work, and then not as much. So, I don't know, it's been weird, because I've actually, like, it's like having a normal job. You know, you wake up at a certain time, and you kind of do your day, and then you can relax a bit more at night. So, it has been a bit different, definitely.
Fine beverage at night, Tom? I've been having a fine beverage at night.
Now and then, Glenn. Now and then, you know.
Well, we got to share a fine beverage after your last trip to Houston. That was a lot of fun, and it was great. It's always great seeing you come into our town, and you've done that now a lot of times with the Mexican national team. But let's get to the big story that I really want to get your information and your insight about, because I think you're going to add a lot to basically what I said, and I've kind of set up the whole MLS and Liga MX Super League and kind of some of the things that are going on, and the letter that Alejandro Iraragorri wrote. So first, I just want to ask you about him. How legit is he? There's a lot of things that tells me he's legit, but he's certainly come out here very aggressive with you know, this model of the future, and he's also kind of let us all know that soccer in Mexico, in his opinion, is in danger. What do you think of all this? How much of this is political?
I mean, Iraragorri, obviously, he owns Santos Laguna and Atlas. He's somebody who is very worldly. You know, he's definitely got a perspective from outside of Mexico looking in. And so he does have a different mentality than some of the other owners and other people in Mexican soccer. And he has been one of the people kind of consistently talking about the US market, about MLS, about what Liga MX can learn from MLS. And so it's not really, it wasn't a surprise that he came out and said, you know, and wrote what he did. But obviously all of this is linked into, you know, really, I don't think it's an overstatement to say it's one of the biggest news stories in Mexican in the last few years of Mexican soccer, which is the suspension of promotion and relegation for 5 years, which, you know, looking at it from the Liga MX MLS point of view, it is an absolutely massive step. It's not definitive, but it's a massive step that Mexican soccer, that Liga MX is saying, look, you know, we used to be in the Libertadores, you know, we used to look south, but now we're looking north. We want to really create this this alliance and see, and basically see where it takes us. So I think, you know, that's how I read what is going on with promotion and relegation. But obviously there's a lot of kind of facets to what's happened over the last week or two.
So in that letter, Tom, from Iraragori, I mean this is not a suggestion. I mean he's pushing and saying basically we need to do this because Mexican soccer is not going to survive the way it is going now, and we need unified thinking. We need to come together. I mean, he's making a real push here. This isn't like a kind of a soft letdown here. He's being very, very aggressive. How is that being taken by the other owners in Liga MX?
Honestly, I think most of the owners kind of agree with him. I mean, the vote was split on kind of on suspending promotion and relegation, but from what I've been hearing, it wasn't necessarily split because they didn't want to suspend it. It was also split because some of the owners didn't like the way that Liga MX clubs are now going to have to kind of fund the second division. They're going to give money each year to second division clubs to make sure that they've got at least a minimum kind of budget each season, so they don't go bust. Because, you know, over the last 3 years, the second division in Mexico, the Ascenso, has gone from 18 clubs to 12. So it's basically, it's been a disaster. The division has been a disaster, and so, you know, basically they've kind of used this crisis and to basically say, look, we need to do something about it. But yeah, I mean, in terms of the, you know, the Liga MX MLS, I mean, I don't know. I just feel, Glenn, I don't know from what you've heard as well, because obviously, you know, you speak to a lot of people in the United States and within MLS, but from what I've heard, it's like, it's not like next year there's going to be suddenly this North American Super League, but very definitely all sides are kind of working towards strengthening this alliance step by step. You know, League Cup, Campeones Cup, All-Stars Game, possibly Interleague play further down the line. And then if everything comes together and that is a success, then I think they'll look very seriously at a kind of a more united, more aligned league, although I don't think it would ever be a full merger.
You don't think there'll ever be a full merger? You don't think there'll be a Super League above Liga MX and Major League Soccer like some are proposing?
It's difficult. It's hard to see. You know, I think it's hard to get your head around how it would work. But what I'm saying is, you know, like the Major League Baseball model, where you've got the American League and the National League, and, you know, those guys didn't, you know, obviously they have the World Series, but they didn't play Interleague until 1997. And so I think MLS and Liga MX are kind of, they're looking at that as you know, how can we can remain to a certain degree independent. You know, it's not like, when I say I don't think a merger could happen, I don't think Liga MX is going to go, okay, we're going to have designated players, we're going to have TAM, we're going to have homegrown rule, you know, all the kind of restrictions that MLS has. I don't think Liga MX needs to buy, you know, collective TV rights, the sponsorship deals. I don't think it has to be the same. They can remain independent, but still play each other within a kind of overriding structure, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, no, and listen, you're bringing up legitimate points here, because the leagues are run very, very differently, but there is obviously things about MLS that you know, those in Mexico now see very attractive when it comes to the financial side of it. And look, the money trail is there. I don't think there's any question. So maybe a Super League, you know, the MLS teams still have to operate under the same rules as they are, or if those rules progress and the Mexican League puts their rosters together in the same way. Maybe that stuff, like you say, doesn't have to merge. But again, what I'm hearing is the Super League above, it's select Mexican League teams and MLS teams, and then below it is MLS and Liga MX domestically still running with the rest of the teams, with two potentially being promoted. And these are all things that are just kind of speculation. But, you know, yeah, when you kind of think of it, you go, well, maybe that will work. All this other stuff. There's so much money to be made.
Yeah. Because, I mean, you get the cream of the crop. I mean, you get the cream of the MLS clubs, the ones that are, you know, really putting money into it, you know, going out and buying massive big-name players. And the same on the Liga MX side, to be honest, because, you know, it's not like every club is actually, you know, doing amazing things in terms of how they're run. But the only thing that I think the problem there is, and I'm looking at this more from the kind of Mexican side, is I don't understand how the Liga MX clubs would agree, for example, for, you know, say Chivas and Atlas are in separate leagues, or Tigres and Monterrey, or even America Chivas, so you don't even have a Clásico Nacional.
So you lose those rivalries.
I don't know how people would get their head around. I'm talking about fans and also owners as well. I just don't think in Mexico that would pass. You know, I think the Mexican football is, you know, it's proved flexible. They changed the rules a lot. You know, they've just changed the relegation system, which, you know, let's not kind of put down how big a deal that is. I mean, what's happened this week is, you know, for a league as historic as the Mexican League, with, you know, that has gone through so much, to kind of make this step towards the United States, towards MLS, is absolutely huge. It's for me, it's a big first step, and I mean, obviously we'll see where it takes us. But I don't think there's any kind of set structure yet. I think it's still a case of Liga MX and MLS are obviously determined about the League's Cup. They need that to work first. And then, like I said, I think possibly interleague play after that. But I think the next step is something that they're just going to have to brainstorm. I don't think that there is, as we speak right now, a plan of how it could necessarily work. Although, obviously, they will be throwing around ideas.
He's Tom Marshall, ESPN FC. He's a tremendous writer. He's very up on everything. He's also on Twitter at Mexico World Cup. By the way, Major League Soccer has been known to be pretty flexible with its rules over the years too. I just thought I would tell you that, Tom, because I know you probably don't know that, but I'm just being a little sarcastic here. Okay, so the next thing I would say to you is this: is this pridefully tough for the Mexican fan, and maybe even some of the Mexican owners, to kind of swallow that, hey, you know, we're trying to align ourselves more with the United States and MLS, and, you know, who's the U.S. to be telling Mexico about soccer?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's definitely two, you know, kind of polar sides to that, and because I think the Liga MX owners, they get it. I think the Liga MX itself completely gets it. I mean, most of the people who run the Mexican clubs are more business people than kind of soccer people. I mean, they get the bottom line. They get that the money's in the States. They get that the economy is very different up there, you know, the biggest economy in the world. And they know that they're on the doorstep of that with already a massive, you know, a massive amount of fans. It's kind of a market on your doorstep that's already there. But I do think that the problem is in the average Mexican fan. I think mainly in Mexico, but in part in the United States as well. I think the criticism that you hear pretty much all the time is, why are we associating ourselves with a league that is inferior? Because obviously, you know, you go to the CONCACAF Champions League, and I think it's now, you know, 15 consecutive times that Liga MX clubs have won the tournament.
Do you have to remind us of that, Tom? Did you have to remind us of that?
But I mean, it's very difficult. It's difficult to sell to the fans. Look, our future is better with MLS because, you know, they've got a great business model and they've been able to attract investment. I mean, the average fan doesn't care about that. You know what I mean? The average fan wants, you know, cares about what's going on in the field and the bragging rights. And I think that's the problem. There's still kind of, I'd say the majority of people would prefer to kind of look south and look towards the Copa Libertadores. Although, you know, I really have my doubts about, you know, the future of, you know, South American soccer in terms of how strong that's going to be in, you know, in terms of the leagues. I mean, I think they're always going to produce really good players, but I think we've seen Argentine clubs over the last 20, 30 years sell young players progressively at an earlier age. And so, I don't know. So it's different. There's a business side and then there's the, you know, the fancies, the soccer side and says, why are we associating ourselves with a league that's kind of inferior?
Well, because of a lot of the things you just said, and there is solidarity there. There's nobody in MLS who's not going to get paid when it comes to being a player. I mean, prior to the coronavirus.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that stability is there. We know that paychecks have not always gone through for all Mexican clubs, and there is a lot of instability in South America and Central America. So, Tom, this is great stuff. We're going to get you on again soon, hopefully, if we can, to keep up on this story because – as you said, this is the biggest story going on right now. I really appreciate you taking the time to come on. I want you to stay safe, and we'll talk with you soon.
Thanks very much, Glenn. Yes, definitely. Speak soon.
All right. He's the one and only Tom Marshall, ESPN FC, at Mexico World Cup on Twitter. Heaven, Psychedelic Furs. Beautiful song. Break.
ESPN 97.5. You are listening to Soccer Matters on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 97.5.com.
Brought to you by the Daspit Law Firm. From the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Glenn Davis.
Fun on the Autobahn. That's the German band Kraftwerk, legendary. By the way, Bundesliga is going to try to start up on 9th and 10th with games played behind closed doors. So there's that. Premier League trying to get back in June behind closed doors. They say 160 staff members need to be at these games. Barcelona, by the way, is going to sell stadium sponsorship and donate the money to the coronavirus. Right now, we talk women's soccer. The Houston Dash is Megan Oyster joining us now. Megan, thank you very much for coming on the program tonight.
Hey, yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for bailing me out, because I needed somebody that's talented like you to come on the show. And, of course, the Houston Dash picked up Megan here coming into the upcoming season. Obviously, this is a weekend that I think the league would have began. Megan was acquired along with Shea Groom and a conditional draft pick from Reign FC in exchange for Sofia Huerta and Amber Brooks. So first thing I'm going to say to you, UCLA Bruins. I called your national championship win over Florida State. Tell me how important that was for you winning the NCAA College Cup.
Oh, man, what a throwback. That was so much fun. Yeah, that was kind of like the turning point in my career, to be honest. It was the first time I kind of started consistently at UCLA, and we got dealt a really, really tough bracket for the tournament and pretty much had to beat every single team. That was just, I mean, Florida State was one of them, but there was North Carolina, Stanford, Virginia, all the really, really good teams right before that. So it was just one of those memories you'll never forget. And, yeah, went into overtime and everything. It was golden goal, and I was able to assist the goal. So just it's something that me and my teammates still talk about to this day.
That was a great game to call. Julie Foudy and I called that game, and that was just so exciting.
Oh,
and like you said, what a run it was. You were knocking off all the best on the way to winning that title. When you were a little kid, and you grew up in Illinois, right? Naperville?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And by the way, that's where the Chicago Fire played for a little while. Who were your biggest influences in the game growing up?
Oh, man. Well, I would have to say the 99 World Cup team was huge for me. I looked up to them in so many ways, and Mia Hamm, Brandi Chastain, all of those girls were just my idols. I had posters of all of them in my room, and yeah, they were probably my number one influence. And then, yeah, the Chicago Fire. I used to go to those games all the time. DeMarcus Beasley, I looked up to him a lot. Yeah, so I think those two were probably the biggest influences for me.
Talking to Megan Oyster, won a national championship at UCLA. She's been on a number of pro teams, Washington Spirit, Boston Breakers, Reign. She has had quite the outstanding career with the Spirit. Got to a title game. No doubt about it. This has been an outstanding career for you. So what have you been doing in the downtime at home? I mean, I asked this question to everybody. I asked it to Christian Ramirez of the Dynamo last week. Does this kind of lapse here? Does this make you appreciate the game and your profession even more?
Oh, my gosh, yeah, so much. I miss the game more than you would know. I think we all do. It's one of those where, yeah, it gets taken away from you, and you kind of just reflect and realize the importance that it has in your life. And I'm lucky and thankful that I have a lot of people in my life that are going through the same thing, not only my Houston Dash teammates, but my old UCLA teammates. And we're all just trying to connect and just, you know, get through it, just like everyone else. But, yeah, it's been tough. I miss soccer a lot. It's almost like that pre-preseason time again for us where it's just kind of you and the ball and just getting some touches in and doing whatever we can to kind of just keep up with it at this point. But, yeah, I miss soccer a lot, that's for sure.
Yeah, what are some of the other things you're doing to stay fit from the directive of James Clarkson and the staff and Eddie Robinson and company?
Yeah, well, we've been doing, a great job just staying together as a team. We do a lot of Zoom calls. James has been great with just coordinating little team events. We have forced family fun on Fridays. So someone comes up with a fun game and we have that little family bonding time. And then on top of that, we do like defender meetings where we watch clips of film and just kind of reflect on the game a little bit to try to stay sharp. So just trying to do the best we can, I think, you know, just like everyone else out there.
Talking to Megan Oyster, defender for the Houston Dash. Now, I could say, you know, here's what type of defender Megan is, but I want you to tell the listeners the type of defender you are and what they can expect from you.
Oh, man, that's a good question.
I like putting it back on the players, you know what I mean? It's fun.
Yeah, that's tough. Well, I just think I have a lot of experience at this point. Like you mentioned earlier, I've been on a lot of teams and played next to and with a lot of really quality players that I've learned from. I was just coached by Vladko Ananovsky, who's now the U.S. national team coach, and he taught me a few things. And I think just bringing that experience to the back line and trying to be an organized unit back there, I make it a goal every year to have a really low percentage of goals against. So I'm going to continue with that on this team as well.
Megan Oyster, defender for the Houston Dash. NWSL was supposed to get off and running here, I believe, this coming weekend. And obviously with the coronavirus, nothing happening there right now. Have you been anxious? You know, because every day everybody's waking up, you know, when are we going to play? And are you able to control that anxiousness, or does it pop up every once in a while?
Oh, yeah, I'm definitely anxious. It's just a lot of unknown, a lot of uncertainty, and just not really sure what's going to happen these next couple of months. But I think one thing that kind of takes my mind off of it is just getting on the ball and playing a little bit. It is kind of lonely, and it's not like playing in a stadium or any of that kind of stuff, but I think just getting out there with the ball really does take my mind off things and just gets me back to the basics. Very anxious, really just kind of waiting here. I feel like I'm like in a horse race, like just building, but as soon as the gates open, I'm ready to go. And that's kind of my mentality through all of this, is I want to just stay ready. So whenever that time is that we'll be free again and able to kind of play and get back to it, I just want to stay ready.
Now, you told me you learned a lot from some of the players you played against, and I would imagine that might have been earlier in your career. Maybe not. Give me one good example and something you learned, because there's, you know, I had that whole relationship with an older center back who taught me a lot of little tricks that made me a better player almost overnight.
Yeah. there's so many things, but I think what stands out the most is just my rookie year because there was so much learning in that year. I played right next to Allie Krieger. So her training habits just, I think, changed me as a player. It wasn't necessarily center back defending stuff. I learned a lot of different tips and tricks from different players like Lauren Barnes. And like I said, Vladko was huge. But, yeah, I think Krieger's training habits just really stuck with me. She was constantly, you know, turned on in training. There was not one moment where she wasn't focused. Every pass mattered to her. Every, like, sprint, turn, cut, like, everything was just really precise. And I just remember watching her day in and day out and just trying to emulate that. And I think every time I go out to training now, I kind of just think of those little moments that kind of, you know, they all matter. They all add up. And you got to build good habits. And I think she was the first one to kind of really instill that in me. So very thankful to play with her. And there's so many other things she taught me, but and a lot of it was just details, focusing on the details and honing in, and it starts with training.
Yeah, that's great. Megan Oyster joining us, newly acquired by the Houston Dash. Outstanding career, national title at UCLA. You were called up to the U.S. Women's National Team before the Russian friendlies in 2017 with Rose Lavelle. How about that experience, getting in with the national team? What did that mean to you?
Oh, man, it's something that's hard to pinpoint, too. It's just a dream come true. I wasn't expecting it. And, yeah, to get that call, it's shocking, almost. I was in tears when I got the call, and just wanted to do everything I could to try to stand out at camp. And, it's funny. It was here in Houston, that little camp that we had. And, it was just a great experience to be surrounded by like the best players, the players that you look up to. Those girls are amazing players and they're there for a reason. So, it was really intense, really tough, really challenging, and tested me in every single way. But very thankful for that experience.
How about when you walk in that locker room with that team and you know, you got to make sure, you know, you got to act like you've been there, right? I mean, You can't crumble, right?
No, yeah, it's a hard balance because you're a rookie, right? Like you know things and you've played and you have experience and they picked you to go to the camp because you're playing well. But then you get there and you just kind of feel like you're not yourself. Everything's new and you just want to do everything right and you don't want to get in your head. So it's this constant like push and pull. Of just being confident and playing like yourself, but also realizing and obviously acknowledging that you're new. So I think that's probably the hardest thing. It's just that push and pull of being extremely ready and like you know what you're doing, but also not being overconfident and not respecting those phenomenal players in the room.
Megan, what are some of the things you do away from the game for our listeners?
What'd you say? Sorry?
What are some of the things you do away from the game? You know, the other interests that you have for our listeners?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the biggest thing of where I spend my time is I work for a nonprofit called Athletes for Hope. We help connect professional Olympic athletes to charity opportunities. It was started by some phenomenal athletes. I mean, Mia Hamm, Lance Armstrong, Andre Agassi. They wanted athletes to have a platform to give back. And once I heard that and learned about this organization, I just reached out to them and really wanted to work for them. So that's where I spend all my time. And right now, obviously, there's a lot to do. And I'm asking athletes to help out in making workout videos for kids and just doing stuff like that. So I spend the majority of my time doing that. I love to go to coffee shops and restaurants and do things like that as well. I like to cook and bake, but... yeah, I would say Athletes for Hope is probably my next thing to soccer.
Wow, that's wonderful. That's important stuff. So I think I'll say thank you for all of that. By the way, how's the coffee these days at home now that you can't go to your coffee shops?
Oh, I'm learning that I don't need to spend as much money as I do normally. So I can make a good enough coffee cup at home, but I do miss the other ones. I've been going to Fix a lot, One's pretty close to where I live and really good coffee shop. So
I'll give you two recommendations when we're allowed to get back out there. Catalina is one of them. I'm only going to give you one tonight. Catalina Coffee in Washington's great. But listen, thank you so much for coming on. This has been great. By the way, you just reminded me of that season with UCLA because I remember you gave away some ridiculously low amount of goals that year, like 5 or 6, and then you had like 19 or 20 shutouts on the year. So it was a remarkable run. Thank you again for coming on tonight.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. This was a lot of fun. I appreciate it.
We'll do it again. Thank you, Megan. Stay safe.
You too. So
That was Megan Oyster of the Houston Dash, and great catching up with her. And Dash fans, you need to get familiar with her because she's one of the new signings. All right, that wraps it up for tonight here. Twitter, Facebook. Let's start with Glenn Davis Sock on Twitter. Facebook, Soccer Matters. Now, glendavissoccer.com. I'm going to give a lot of credit here to Victor Ariza. He's revamped this website. We're putting new blogs up every day. There's a lot of Houston history stuff. There's a mix of stuff. I had something up there recently just about how games behind closed doors would be so interesting with audio and hearing players and everybody talking. So go there. Instagram, Glenn Davis Sock. We're going to keep pouring the content out. I've been pushed to do more content. We're going to close it down with Gary Newman tonight. A big thank you to Nick Sharara for pushing us through this show for 2 hours. Tomorrow night, it's in Austin Soccer Matters. On the horn, Josh Wolf is our guest. Good night from Glenn Davis.